Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Johnson, Judge Cleary. The Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Let's take a quick second here to get ready. For purposes of recording, I'll note that today is February 8th, 2024. We have four oral cases on our calendar today. As you may be aware, we are now live streaming our oral arguments, so you'll see some equipment in the room to help facilitate that. And just as a reminder, we are also making an audio recording, and that will be available on our website usually within 24 hours. No other recordings are permitted other than with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. So to anyone who's watching, you can find the recording on our website tomorrow. With that, we will begin hearing cases. The first case on our calendar today is A23-0983, Dale Leroy Teedy versus Daniel J. Sullivan. And counsel for appellant, if I mispronounce that name, please correct me. Each party will have 15 minutes for your argument. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If counsel can please introduce themselves and the party they represent at the beginning of their argument, we would appreciate it. And you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kimberly Woodgate, and I represent appellant Daniel Sullivan. We are here this morning seeking reversal of the lower court's order finding that my client did not meet the necessary elements of adverse possession and that this case is not a boundary line dispute under the tax exemption of 541.02. The standard of review is de novo. In light of this court's recent opinion in Starbeck versus Gibson, I would like to begin there to explain to you why Mr. Sullivan's case still meets those elements, even with the narrowed description in Starbeck. First off, the main point of this is that Section 541.02 provides a tax payment exemption for boundary line disputes, including those boundary line issues that are created by the adverse possession.
So in Starbeck, I was on that panel, and my reading of that case is that boundary line disputes that are created by adverse possession are not boundary line disputes, that you can't create a boundary line dispute by claiming you don't know where the boundary is as a result of adverse possession. So can you help me understand how you're reading Starbeck to allow that type of claim? Because as I read your brief, you're not disputing the legal descriptions. You're saying that there is a boundary line dispute based on adverse possession.
Correct. And while I don't fully intend to argue Attorney Kluver's positions for him, there are a couple of things that I would ask the court to pay attention to. First off, the nature of adverse possession by itself begins with a willful intent. It can. The Rupley case, the Mattson versus Warner case say that adverse possession, in fact, usually does begin with a naked willful trespass, an intent to claim land other than your own. The difference is that over time, we're looking at possibly a transition into the realm of a boundary dispute. That was the case of Rupley versus Frazier, where Rupley fully admitted at first that he did not own that property. He said, I'm making no legal claim to this, but the court said that after a certain point in time that he was entitled to adverse possession of it. Because of the way the Starbeck opinion was written and the two exceptions, specific cases that the court listed giving those exceptions, I believe that we still can have some genuine confusion as to the true boundary line because, as I'll explain further down, there are three potential options as to what the court could look out for a boundary line dispute.
Would you agree that there is no dispute regarding the legal descriptions of the two parcels and that the boundary between those, as described by the legal descriptions, is clear?
Yes, I would agree that there is no confusion or discrepancy as to what the legal description states and what the first potential boundary line was. However, I would specifically note that boundary lines can change over time, either by nature or by man's action. Specifically, rivers have been known to move over time, and that's just an accepted common knowledge fact of property owners that have lakefront property. Depending on the movement of the river, they either lose or gain property. And the legal description is not revised, you know, every 5 or 10 years to adjust that.
Council, I'm a little bit confused. The previous landowners to parcel A and B never had any doubt about the boundary. It's just your client now who says that there's a boundary dispute.
So the reason for that is specifically because when we look at the phrase pushing the boundaries, that refers to an action that goes beyond what is an established norm or expected behavior. The expected behavior prior to the County Road 26 being curved was that that was the boundary line. It was a straight line. When the county curved the road, that created the potential for a different boundary, and the Marek family took full advantage of that, as any good economic businessman farmer would do. They literally pushed the boundary of their field out and into the disputed triangle in order to take advantage of that extra tillable. So that was the prior boundary. Nobody is disputing that. However, what we are saying is they literally pushed that boundary out and used as much extra as they could and therefore created the new boundary.
That by is the adverse possession.
Correct.
So in Starbuck, this court, well, first of all, I just want to make sure you agree that there's no dispute that appellant did not pay property taxes for the triangle in question for 5 years as required by the statute.
That is correct. However, we do believe that this boundary line dispute falls under that exception.
And okay, Your Honor, I just want to go back to Starbuck then.
Yes, I believe I understand
if you can
what you're missing.
Let me point you to the language in Starbuck that I'd like to ask you about, and then you can explain why you think it's distinguishable. So in Starbuck, we said Starbuck maintains that this case is therefore a boundary line dispute, with respondents claiming the boundary of record, so the legal boundary, and appellant claiming the boundary as a matter of law. That seems similar to this case. But as we conclude in the next section, Starbuck's adverse possession claim to the encroached farm property never ripened because he paid no property taxes as required by section 541.02. Starbuck therefore never achieved any title by operation of law and his argument fails. So we concluded that you can't create a boundary line dispute by virtue of adversely possessing the property.
The difference there, though, is that Starbuck never claimed any ownership of the property. He never claimed that he believed that he owned up to the boundary line. The difference here is that the Marek family pushed this boundary out and then operated as if it were their own for so long that by the time even Mr. Hansen purchased it, when he looked at the aerial maps, the FSA maps, everything, that extra tillable acre was virtually indistinguishable from the rest of the field. Hansen then, from that point on of purchase, believed that he owned it. He acted as if he owned it. Same for Mr. Sullivan. He believed he was buying that. He acted as if he was buying that. And that is directly on point with the Melanthin case that the Starbuck court referenced, saying they looked at what the parties believed they own and how they acted. In this case, even Mr. Titi acted as if the parcel owner of Marek Hansen and Sullivan's parcel owned that disputed triangle. That's direct evidence because he stopped farming it when Mr. Hansen no longer renewed his lease. With that, I will say, though, that this does help create the idea or fall within the requirement that there is genuine confusion. Because when we look at the actions and beliefs of the parties, the Marek family is the one that initially entered into land that they knew was not their own. But over time, they created it as their own. They met these elements of adverse possession to the point that when Mr. Hansen and Mr. Sullivan purchased it, they believed that they owned that property. So there's three potential boundary lines that we could be looking at. The first one where the old road was, the second one where the new road is curved, which would be the Allens versus Klug case, where the court stated that the boundary was all the way into the triangle because that's how a normal farmer would farm it, or is it the boundary line created by just the tillable acreage? The fact that we have three potential boundaries that could all very validly be argued to the court shows that there is sufficient genuine confusion as to what the appropriate boundary is.
Well, here, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the district court found there was no confusion as to the actual boundary.
I think the dispute there is the word actual or true boundary. Are we talking about what the original boundary is or what the boundary is that has been created by adverse possession? That's where I believe the disagreement is in the wording.
And isn't that where Starbuck comes into play?
It does, except for the differences. Starbuck is slightly against the previous cases regarding adverse possession that state that adverse possession can start by willful intent to trespass and then turn into a boundary line dispute. One specific example I would like to lay out for you in Starbuck that would necessarily need to allow this court to create a clarification or exception for it is, for example, somebody who purchases a house that the house is very clearly 5 or 10 feet over into the neighbor's property. And the person who built that house did it intentionally. They knew where the line was. They built that house on purpose, didn't care. Then the person who comes in, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years later, purchases that house, is given the legal description, as in the case here, and then the neighbor says, well, that's, you're on my land, take down your house. And you say, no, it's been here for 20 years, it's adverse possession. And the court says, nope, because the first person built it that way intentionally, and when you purchased, you were given a legal description, their constructive knowledge of the property line, you now have to tear down your house or tear down at least a portion of it. That's kind of the result that it seems that Starbuck would be presenting if there weren't an exception for a second property owner that comes in after the fact. And that's probably what I would argue is necessary here, is to say that, you know, because the Marek family intended to push into it, that can't necessarily carry over into Mr. Hansen and Mr. Sullivan, because by the time they purchased it, they were not the one that were
but
that
at
intentionally
the time,
did it.
At the time, you're arguing the Marek family pushed into it, but they were renting for part of the time, correct?
Correct. They rented Parcel A, the Washa property, until they quit farming in 1994. In 1994, when Mr. Titi took over both leases, the Marek family included that disputed triangle with their lease to Mr. Titi. Mr. Titi rented from Mr. Washa, but that lease, the Washa lease to Marek and the Washa lease to Mr. Titi were identical, which means that the triangle was not included.
Weren't they? Well, I'm not sure. How do you get there? Because I thought the leases covered Parcel A and Parcel B.
That was the court's opinion in it, in that it said Section 6 and Section 7. However, when you look at what the parties were actually doing out of practicality, which is part of what we look at for adverse possession, we know what things say on paper, but what did the parties believe? Well, how were they acting? How were they treating it? All of the parties, Mr. Washa, Titi, Marek, Hansen, Sullivan, everybody down the line until Mr. Titi purchased this property, up until then, everybody treated it as if the disputed triangle was part of the Sullivan property, the lower one. That's evidence because when you look at the FSA maps, the crop insurance certification maps, the disputed triangle was never included in the acreage or the mapped out description with Wash's property. Since that extra acre was created, it has always, always been attached to the Sullivan parcel.
Did those maps show property lines?
They do. They show, they're just a kind of general mapped out. These two farm parcels are the, you know, typical straight rectangle 40-80-acre parcel that's mapped out. The FSA maps, if you look at it, typically how it is somebody takes a red or black Sharpie and will draw a line on the field showing where the crops are that they planted. If you look at those
maps.
But
that doesn't show ownership. It shows who planted it, correct?
The visual map does not show ownership, but the certification report does say ownership. It does list who owns that farm field because quite often farmers will rent other fields that they don't own. So it does show ownership. The key thing here is not necessarily to show ownership of it, but to show how the parties were treating it. They were consistently treating it as part of the Sullivan parcel.
Counsel, it seems to me that whenever anyone makes an adverse possession claim and hasn't paid taxes, they're going to claim it's a boundary dispute. It's the only way to save their case. But just saying that it's a boundary dispute doesn't make it one.
Agreed? That's correct. The characteristics here do indicate, actually, that it is a boundary line dispute. It's directly on point with the Ganji case that was noted in Starbuck in that the boundary of it is not a straight line. They created a kind of, you know, up and over zigzag line to add this character. And when we look at the practical location of it, it's not into Mr. Wash's actual tillable field. It's just pushed into a grassy area.
The district court cites Stolmeyer. Why is that wrong?
The district courts, all three of the district court opinions now in our or district court, Supreme Court, Court of Appeals opinions in Stolmeyer do not prohibit Mr. Sullivan's claim here because what we are looking at is the nature of it. This the small portion that literally just bumped up the line and pushed it out. A little bit here. The reason that Stolmeyer, the tax payment requirement, doesn't apply here is because specifically for Mr. Hansen and Mr. Sullivan, as I noted, when they purchased the property, they believed they owned it. So as diligent property owners paying their taxes year after year, they probably believed that they were paying taxes on it. This is what they thought they owned. With that, I see my time as ended. For these reasons, we would ask that the court reverse the lower court and find that Mr. Sullivan has, in fact, met the elements of adverse possession and the tax payment requirement does not apply. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Dan Sagstetter. I represent the respondents in this matter, Dale and Patricia Titi, who are present in the gallery this morning. May it please the court, counsel, it appears to me that this court is very familiar with the facts of this case, having reviewed, I assume, all of the briefs. So I'd like to, I guess, start by just addressing some of the questions that the court had for my opposing counsel. You're correct, there was no confusion about where this boundary line was. It's a section line. There's a fence right across one of the other roads, which the court pointed out as being a way to know exactly where that line was. In addition, there's this discussion, or was this discussion, about whether Mr. Hansen, before selling the property to Mr. Sullivan, knew where the line was. And if you look at the deed from Mr. Hansen to Mr. Sullivan, you'll see he didn't convey anything in Section 6, only Section 7. And that's because he knew he didn't own anything north of that section line.
What about appellant's argument that he farmed it and treated it as... or it was farmed as if it was Hansen's property?
Well, it was farmed by Mr. Titi,
right,
as if it was the property. And at the time, Mr. Titi had a lease, having acknowledged the rightful owner with the Washa Trust or Mr. Washa. So he was acknowledging the rightful ownership. He could have farmed it any way he wanted because he had permission from both the northern property owner and the southern property owner. He had acknowledged their titled rights. And as a result, he could farm as practicality however he wanted. Now, when the property was sold by Mr. Hansen to Mr. Sullivan, practicality became more difficult. While there were two accesses to this triangle from the county road that was moved, getting a big piece of equipment across the road to that is not simple. And Mr. Titi had to think through, as he testified, how am I going to do that? I'm going to get all of my other stuff in, and then this little parcel I'm going to have to worry about later. In the meantime, Mr. Hansen had sold to Mr. Sullivan, and Mr. Sullivan had planted a crop. So in response, Mr. Teedy went to the rightful owner, the person he was renting from, Mr. Washa, and said, hey, somebody's renting your or using your property that I rent. What are we going to do? And Mr. Washa told him, I'll take care of it. Unfortunately, Mr. Washo lived in Texas. He was a sick man, and he passed away about 10 years later, and he never took care of it, despite Mr. Teedy asking him to. And then the kids come to Mr. Teedy and say, we'd like to sell you this property. And Mr. Teedy says, great, I'll buy it. And he buys the entire thing, triangle included. It's in the deed. He paid money for it. He purchased it. And as part of that transaction, he asked the Washa family to send a letter to Mr. Sullivan saying, hey, you don't own this. We've sold it to Mr. Teedy and his wife. Please stop using it. And Mr. Sullivan's response through his attorney was, no, I own it by adverse possession. So Mr. Teedy hired a lawyer to start a quiet title action, this action. And Mr. Sullivan stipulated in his deposition and then again at the beginning of trial that the Teedys were the titled owners of all of the property in Section 6, both the part north of the road and the part south of the road. They agreed to that. The only thing they contested is whether they had asserted an adverse possession claim. And to get there, they had to have paid the taxes for 5 years. They agree. There's no dispute. They didn't do that. They also have to have held it, physically possessed it adversely for 15 years. And Mr. Sullivan didn't. He possessed it for 10. Mr. Teedy possessed it prior to that, pursuant to written leases with both property owners. And in fact, the evidence shows that Mr. Merrick was in fact was possessing parcel A, including that triangle, during at least some of the period that he had it. He had acknowledged the rightful titled owner's possession or right to have that property.
Do the FSA maps show that there is a boundary dispute in this case?
No, the FSA maps, if you look at them, actually show the section line on it. And the FSA maps, by law, are required to be reported based upon what you farm. And there are all sorts of rules and regulations about who can be the owner, who can be the operator, and how you can do register that with the FSA. But they're not in, the federal government in terms of that program is not trying to figure out who owns it. They're trying to figure out how it's being farmed. A byproduct of that is they want either the owner or the operator reporting to them, but they're not saying, oh, do you own this? Where's the title record? How does this work? They're saying, you tell us, and if you tell us and swear under oath that it's true, great. And remember, these properties were being farmed together through leases or through ownership for a very, very, very long time. The Merricks farmed it with a lease for the property owner to the north and owned the property to the south. Then Mr. Teedy took over and farmed it for about 16 years through a lease with the property owner to the north and a property owner to the south. The operator never changed.
During the period when the road moved and the Merricks were farming the triangle, they had a lease to parcel A, is that correct?
Yes.
The road moved in 1978.
That is my understanding of the testimony.
So they started, based on my reading of the record, and I could very well be wrong, but the Merricks started renting parcel A in 1980, is that correct?
At least as early as 1980. As I recall, the record wasn't clear on exactly when the road was moved. There was conflicting testimony as to whether it was 78, 79, or 80. My recollection is that the Merricks were renting the farm to the north at the time of the move, and even prior to. And that's part of why I understand they were able to push north without objection, because they had a right to do so under their lease. That's my understanding and recollection of the testimony. It has been a year since all that occurred, but that's what I recall. I can certainly continue to talk about or field questions about the adverse possession. I would like to address a couple of the other issues if the court is okay with that.
I have one more question about adverse possession. Appellant argues that this case is similar to the Ganji case, where there was a boundary dispute and the parties walked the area in an attempt to determine the boundary line. So is this case like that case, or is this case more like Starbuck?
I would say it's more like Starbuck. We thought when
Starbuck. And how is this case distinguishable from the Ganji case?
My understanding of the Ganji case is that in large part Domeyer overruled it. The testimony regarding walking the property line was mixed, and the district court presumably credited the testimony of Mr. Titi over the testimony of Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan testified that his father, not his father coming to testify, that he understood his father walked the property line. Mr. Titi testified they did, but not in the sense of actually walking the boundary, just talking about, hey, you're my new neighbor, how's this going to work? And lo and behold, he found out they're going to try and take this piece of land that he is supposed to be renting, Mr. Titi is supposed to be renting, and he had to follow up then with the property owner. Mr. Titi testified, and I think the court credited this testimony, Mr. Titi didn't feel it was his place as a renter, a lessor, to upset the relationship between the two adjacent property owners. He felt he had to go to the person who was leasing him the land and say, hey, this is what's happening. I have to let you take care of it because I don't want you to all of a sudden say I'm not going to lease to you anymore. And he was making this business judgment of, I've got 1 acre. I think I should be entitled to rent it, but I have these 23 other ones I want to do. And I want Mr. Washer to take care of it. And at the first opportunity where Mr. Titi and Ms. Titi could actually address the issue directly as the property owner, they did. They did it at the time they were closing on the sale. And then within months of that, followed up by actually starting a quiet title action. Let me look at. I was trying to find the reference to Ganji in the appellant's brief. But the reference is to page 28, and I don't see it on page 28. There is a quoted part that's not cited. I'm not sure if that's it. But if it is, the quote is, it may be conceded for the purpose of a decision of this appeal only that if the continuity of the defendant's alleged adverse possession was not broken by an acknowledgement of the true owner's title, and then it goes on to talk about what that means. In this case, there was an acknowledgement of the true owner's title for that disputed parcel from sometime in late 70s to early 80s, all the way up through 2010. That breaks any claim of adverse possession from that entire time period, even prior.
Okay, thank you.
The other two issues that the district court addressed that have been appealed, one deals with the crops that were present on the land when the TDs purchased it. We've cited a case, and the district court and the appellant at trial essentially agreed whoever owns the land was entitled to harvest those crops. And that's what the district court found. The final issue that the district court addressed was this issue of a prescriptive easement for this drain tile. And there are essentially two pieces of drain tile. There's a piece of drain tile that was put in 1980 or earlier that was effectively abandoned and not in use at the time Mr. Sullivan purchased the property. That's the one that the district court said the Marketable Title Act applies to bar any further claim because notice of that was not of record when the TDs purchased it more than 40 years later. The appellants have suggested that that issue was not raised at the district court. The respondents raised both the statute of limitations, which that is, in the answer to the counterclaims, and it was specifically in our post-trial brief. We cited the Marketable Title Act and argued it. By contradiction, the appellants have now raised for the first time on appeal this issue of reasonable flow of water. And that was an issue that we had contemplated might come up at trial, but did not. And you'll see in our brief, in one of the footnotes, we had an exhibit to specifically address that, that in fact the flow of water was increased by these tile lines when they were put in 40 or more years ago. And I would have taken testimony on it had that issue actually been raised, but it was not. It was not raised during any of the testimony, and it was not raised in any of the argument post-trial. The first time it came up was on appeal here before you in the appellant's initial brief. Based on this court's case law, I believe that that issue is not appropriately before the court. The second piece of drain tile is tile that was installed either in 2018 or 2020. Both of those pieces of drain tile don't meet the prescriptive easement requirements because the 15 years of adverse possession are not met, clearly. In addition, testimony came out from one of the appellant's contractors who installed the tile in 2020. That contractor said that Mr. Sullivan told him he knew there was a dispute about the ownership of that triangle in 2020, and he told the contractor to install it anyway. And I can tell you, I sat at the counsel table during that testimony, and I watched that person essentially shrug an apology to Mr. Sullivan. He knew it was damaging testimony, and he said it anyway. He knew, Mr. Sullivan knew he didn't own it. And at the core of this adverse possession prescriptive easement conversation is, does the law allow somebody with the statute requiring payment of taxes to intentionally take land without paying for it? That's the core. And I think that once the legislature passed this statute, they were essentially saying, no, if you take it, you got to pay for it, unless it's a true dispute about the boundary. We don't know where it is, so we picked a fence line, and we used the fence line for 15 years, and now we discovered we were wrong. Okay, everyone was, they didn't know. So we're going to let it just lie, try and keep the peace. That, I think, is the state of the law for adverse possession. I see I have about 50 seconds left. I'm happy to address any questions you have, but I feel like the court has a very good handle of the issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No further questions from the panel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
First, I would like to point out a few differences between the Sullivan case and the Starbeck case. As previously noted, Starbeck never claimed that he fully believed that he owned any of that property. This is very different from here. We had testimony by Marek Hansen and Sullivan that they all believed they owned it. The actions...
So, but that argument, I think, depends on us finding that the district court's factual findings are clearly erroneous, correct?
I do believe they are, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes. If you look at the evidence, we have to look at the evidence and the testimony. Mr. Teedy has not presented one shred of actual evidence to support his claim that he believed that he was renting that disputed triangle from Mr. Washa in the Washa lease. There's nothing to show that. On the other side, we have every single FSA map, we have every single lease showing the acreage didn't change, showing that when Mr. Teedy stopped farming it, when Mr. Sullivan purchased, that he didn't get a reduction in rent price, that the acreage didn't go down. It's very hard to believe that Mr. Teedy would continue to pay and for an acre of land for 11 years that he's not allowed to farm. I think the court has to look at the actual facts and say the evidence does not support the lower court's finding in this. Also,
can I stop you there a minute? The district court on page 17 said that defendant Sullivan was not a credible witness. So does your argument depend on our overturning that credibility determination?
I do believe so, Your Honor. I believe that Mr. Sullivan was a credible witness because he has the documents to back it up. He has all the witness testimony. Every witness that was brought in by Mr. Sullivan's side and supported every claim that we made. the maps, the lease agreements, even Mr. Titi's own testimony that he farmed it with the Sullivan parcel out of practicality, even his testimony that he admitted this was a boundary line dispute. That was one of the questions that the court asked in Starbuck. Where in the record, or is there any evidence in the record that the parties considered this to be a boundary line dispute? That wasn't in the record in Sullivan, or in Starbuck. It is in the record here in Sullivan, including Mr. and Mrs. Titi both stating that this is a boundary line issue. If there are no further questions on the boundary line dispute issue, I will just briefly touch on the Marketable Title Act reasonable use doctrine. This was an interesting situation, as noted in our brief, in that the Marketable Title Act was not brought up until post-trial briefings. The post-trial briefs were due on the same day. We had absolutely no knowledge that that argument was coming and that it was, and we had no opportunity to respond to it. That's the whole reason why parties are not allowed to bring new arguments on appeal, is because there's no opportunity to respond. So that is exactly what happened to us, essentially. In that regard, then, the appropriate rebuttal is that the reasonable use doctrine does supersede the Marketable Title Act, mainly because we're talking about the natural flow of water, and that's something that parties are not allowed to prevent. And there was testimony by all parties that at least some of the water draining off the Sullivan Field goes through the disputed triangle. So under the reasonable use doctrine, that should be allowed to continue. Not only that, but the evidence shows that with Mr. Sullivan's updates and fixes to the drain tile, it actually helped reduce the amount of water that was going through that disputed triangle, because it meant that his crop could soak up more of the water. So it wasn't an increased burden on Mr. Titi in any way. Mr. Titi showed no detriment, no damages at all by this tile being there. And in fact, it helps his property as well, because it keeps the water moving. So the general public policy doctrine of reasonable use should apply here, because it's been in place since, you know, everybody testified, since the 1960s, essentially. And it goes along with what the nature of the land already was doing. So we would ask
that. Ask you a question about the Marketable Title Act issue. Would you agree that that's a legal issue?
It is a legal issue, yes. And that's why I believe that the reasonable use doctrine supersedes that, because the reasonable use doctrine of the water flow goes along with what is naturally occurring. So that's something that would be significantly harder and more detrimental for parties to have to stop and change. The Marketable Title Act is just a legal issue that you can make up. You can say there's rules to do this or that, whatever. But when you're looking at the natural flow of water, that's something that, that man doesn't do. That's going to occur naturally. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything further you'd like to argue? You have a few more. Well, your time is up, I see. Do you have any brief concluding remarks?
Just, Your Honor, as I said before, that we ask that this court find that the district court's findings of fact were, in fact, clearly erroneous, and Mr. Sullivan did meet the elements of adverse possession. And, in fact, this is a boundary line dispute that would not require him to pay the taxes under 541.02. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments here today. They were very helpful. Case is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.